of my presentation on 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 with an investigation of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Obviously, Steve will agree that this is a foundational text. He believes it applies to the future. If, therefore, I can demonstrate that this text refers to the events of AD 70, to the resurrection, the parousia at that time, then my affirmative will have been established. So if we can determine the time and the framework of Thessalonians, then, again, my position will be established. And I believe that we can establish that in a variety of different ways. Now, obviously, I've only got, you know, a very short period of time here. But I want to do this. Now, Steve said we have similar language found throughout Scripture. Well, that's obviously true. I mean, it's an excellent point. When we find, however, the identical language with the identical motifs, with the identical time statements made at the same time, then that, to me, becomes a very, very persuasive, consistent hermeneutic. Now, I know that the fall of Edom, for instance, in Isaiah chapter 34 was fulfilled because Malachi chapter 1 says so, but it uses the same language as the destruction of Tyre, Sidon, Assyria, etc., etc. But those are different time periods, okay? Same language of clouds, day of the Lord, etc., but different time periods. Well, the interesting and I think significant fact is that all of the New Testament writers, while using the exact same identical language, all use the same identical temporal statements of imminence. Now, I want you to pay attention to Matthew 16, 27 and 28, where Jesus said, "The Son of Man will come in the glory of the Father with his angels and shall reward every man according to his work. And verily I say unto you, there are some standing here which shall not taste of death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Now, I want you to compare that with Matthew chapter 24, in which Jesus is talking about the coming of the Son of Man with the angels, the time of the gathering, at the time of the judgment. Remember Matthew 16, 27, the time of the judgment of all men. And just like Matthew 16, pardon me, is the time of the coming of the kingdom. Likewise, Jesus described the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70 as the time of the coming of the kingdom. Luke chapter 21 and verse 31. Notice the emphatic temporal delimiters, that is, the time statements that demand that we keep it within a certain time frame. Jesus said, "There are some standing here which shall not taste of death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Just like Matthew 24, 34, "This generation shall by no means pass away." Now, Steve believes, I believe this is accurate, but Steve believes that Matthew 16, 27, 28 applies to AD 70, the coming of the kingdom in judgment, as well as Matthew chapter 24. Well, how does he do that? Well, you have the identical language being used, okay, same identical motifs, but you also have the exact same time reference, the same language of imminence. So, what is the nature or the difference in the nature of these texts? Well, there is none. Why? Because of the time factor and because of the identical nature. And because you have the kingdom, well, unless the kingdom was going to come at many, many different times, you know, you've got to limit that. All right, let's go on. Look at Matthew 16, 27, 28, and compare it with Matthew 25, 31 and following. Now, Steve takes Matthew 25, 31 and following as future, end of time event. But wait a minute. In both texts, we have the exact precise language, the coming of the Son of Man with the angels, the judgment of all. Now notice, Matthew 16, 27 and 28 is the coming of the Son of Man in his kingdom. Matthew 25, 31, "When the Son of Man shall come with all of his glorious angels, then shall he sit on the throne of his kingdom." We got the exact same concept, the exact same event being described. Well, some standing here in Matthew chapter 16, 27, 28, and this generation of Matthew chapter 24, therefore becomes the controlling time element of Matthew chapter 25, I would suggest. And if not, why not? So what we would need from Steve would be an exegetical reason, okay? And again, I agree perfectly well with his comment that similar language is used in a lot of different passages. Similar language does not prove identical topic. I agree with that 100%. So we have to be very careful students in seeking to take, okay, here's the coming of the Son of Man, here's the coming of the Son of Man. Are they different? Can they be different? Why are they different? Why must I delineate between these texts? And I suggest to you, because Matthew 16, Matthew 24, and Matthew 25 are all talking about the coming of the Son of Man in His kingdom, that we are all but forced, and by the way, at the time of judgment. Unless we want to say that Christ came in His kingdom, sat on His throne in judgment of all men at the gathering of the nations at multiple different occasions, then I think we would have a very serious problem in dichotomizing between this. Now then, I want you to turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13 and following, in which Paul said, "This we say to you by the word of the Lord." Now, the scholarly consensus, now, I'm going to give a little caveat. Steve and I would both say scholarly consensus. You can take that and a quarter and buy something. I don't know what it is anymore, Steve, but anyway, you can take that and a quarter and buy something. Because scholars can be every bit as wrong as anybody. There is, however, a scholarly consensus that when Paul said, "This we say to you by the word of the Lord," he was referencing, or what he was saying is, I'm reminding you of what Jesus said in His teaching on eschatology. Well, I believe that is accurate. You know, some have suggested, well, what Paul was really saying, well, I'm giving a new revelation. I don't believe that. Paul said he got his gospel from Christ Himself. Could that be some new revelation that Jesus did not give? Certainly it could be, if we're trying to be objective about it, and we want to be as objective and honest to all Paul's possibilities. But if it's true that Paul in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 is drawing from the Olivet Discourse, it is highly significant that the only place in all of Jesus' teachings in which every constituent element mentioned by Paul in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 is to be found in Matthew 24, 29 to 34. The only place. Now, if, or since, I believe, this is true, it forces us to examine these parallels even more closely and consider the implications of that. And I believe that when we do that, it becomes abundantly and undeniably clear that 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 was fulfilled in AD 70. Now, for those of you who do not know, and I'm not trying to hawk a book by any means, but for those who wish to look more carefully at in depth at these issues, I've written a book entitled We Shall Meet Him in the Air, The Wedding of the King of Kings. It is the only and the first and only full preterist commentary on 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 that I'm aware of that's ever been written. It's a real, real short book. It's only 453 pages long. You can read it in 3 minutes, right? Okay. Anyway, so notice the perfect parallels between Matthew 24 and 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We have the coming of the Son of Man on the clouds with the angels, the gathering of the elect at the sound of the trumpet, and the emphatic statement, "This generation shall not pass away." We find those exact same parallels in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Now, Steve wanted to say, well, this language, those of us who are alive. And he says, well, Paul was alive. Well, that's true. But could Paul not be speaking in a corporate sense? Just like "this generation shall not pass" didn't say who would die and who would not die. It was a corporate statement. This generation, corporately considered, will not pass away. So I agree with Steve on one hand, maybe to that much degree, you know, that the statement doesn't have to include Paul, and certainly didn't, because Paul died before the event. That's undeniably historically true. That does not preclude the idea that Paul's language was speaking of that generation. How much different is the language, "we who are alive and remain," different from "this generation shall not pass"? I don't find a substantive difference in that kind of language. So I would suggest that Steve has a responsibility, being in the negative, to prove beyond a doubt, and to prove it exegetically, that Thessalonians is not typical apocalyptic language. Now, Steve well understands, as one of the things I've admired listening to his tapes, Steve understands that the language of coming on the clouds with power and great glory, with the angels, the shout and the trumpet, flaming fire, he understands that's apocalyptic metaphoric language. Okay, so my question would be, if the consistent and the persistent use of that kind of language, the coming of the Lord on the clouds with the angels, the shout, et cetera, is consistently metaphoric, then upon what hermeneutic principle do we come to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and say, oh, well, I know how Paul's always used it. I know how Isaiah used it. I know how old prophets used it. But now it's got to be literal. what is the hermeneutic that demands that? See, a presuppositional futurist eschatology, like I once had, is not sufficient. We have to have the exegetical evidence from the text that says, yes, the language sounds the same as all this metaphoric language, but I know it's different because, okay? I do not believe that he can demonstrate the clear-cut distinction in that language. So I would ask Steve to try to give us the exegetical, contextual, and textual evidence for delineating from Matthew 24 and 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and especially in the light that Paul says, what I'm saying to you, I've got it from Jesus, i.e. from his former teaching. Now, I want you to notice that Paul says, now concerning those who have fallen asleep in Christ, the question therefore is, who were those who had died? Were they Christians who had died from just the normal human experience? Well, I'm sure some of them were. I'm not going to deny that. Or do we have reason to believe that some of them were martyrs, and that Paul very much has the vindication of the martyrs in mind? And if so, if they were, and if Paul has the vindication of the martyrs, the glorification of the martyrs in mind, then that demands that we take a fresh look at the temporal context of fulfillment. And as I've suggested to you, suffering and martyrdom are dominant themes in Thessalonians in both epistles. Now, it's almost undoubtedly true that some of those in Thessalonians had died a martyr's death. Notice again that all of these passages that I've already shared with you from Thessalonians, in which Paul talks about the martyrdom, the suffering that they were experiencing at that given time in the streets of Thessalonica. So my argument would be like this. The dead, or at least some of the dead, of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 were martyrs. 1 Thessalonians 2:15, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. But Jesus said, all of the blood of all the righteous from Abel onward would be vindicated in his coming in the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Therefore, the dead of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, being included in that number, filling up the measure of sin that Jesus talked about in Matthew 23, that Paul talked about in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, the dead of 1 Thessalonians 4 would be vindicated at Christ's parousia in AD 70. Now, Steve said this concept of martyrdom and vindication is a very common theme. That's the point I was trying to make. One thing that Steve omitted was, in every one of the passages that I adduced, there is the promise, in the first century promise, of imminent vindication. Now, we've already looked at the correlation between Matthew 23 and 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Steve said he believes that 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 is fulfilled in AD 70. But let me shift gears really quickly to a motif that I think is absolutely critical. Virtually all scholarship agrees that the wedding of Christ is at the parousia of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Now, if the wedding of Christ, of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, occurred at Christ's coming in AD 70, then I believe my proposition is affirmed or established. Point number one, Jesus came to confirm the promises made to the Old Covenant promises made to the Old Covenant fathers, Romans 15, verse 8. And the wedding was, as a matter of fact, one of Jesus' very favorite topics and themes. And the promise of the wedding of Christ was nothing but the hope of Israel. It was not a promise given to the church divorced, pun intended, divorced from Israel. This is absolutely critical to understand. Now, Steve made a comment a while ago that he believed that most Old Testament prophecy is fulfilled. I certainly agree with that. And in debate, he said all prophecies made to Israel have been fulfilled. Matter of fact, in one of his tapes on the destruction of Jerusalem, he said, commenting on Luke 21:22, I do not know of any Old Testament passage that speaks of a later fulfillment than that is AD 70. Well, I would suggest to you that if all Old Testament promises to Israel have been fulfilled, then the redemption of creation has arrived, then the wedding has taken place. And so let me skip right on this. Look at Christ in the wedding. In Matthew chapter 8, Jesus says, many shall come from the east and the west and shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob at the table in the kingdom. This is the messianic wedding banquet table. When would it be? When the sons of the kingdom are cast out. Matthew chapter 22, those who had been invited to the wedding rejected the offer. They killed the servants sent to them. The master of the wedding sends out his armies. He destroys those wicked men and burns their city and calls others to the wedding. The wedding takes place at the fall of Jerusalem. Matthew 25, the wise and the foolish virgins, the coming of the groom, second coming of Christ. So we have the wedding motif as a very prominent doctrine in Jesus' teaching. And it's a common theme in the rest of the New Testament. For instance, at the fall of Babylon, the city where the Lord was slain, by the way, at the fall of Babylon, it is said, let us rejoice, for the time of the wedding of the marriage of the Son has come. Okay? Look how this correlates perfectly well with Paul's statement in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, we who are alive and remain. If the wedding of Christ was to be at the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, Matthew chapter 22, if it was to be at the fall of Jerusalem, Revelation chapter 19, then Paul's statement, we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord, which is the coming of the Lord for His wedding, definitely had to be in that generation. Well, I'm going to skip right over this because my time is drawing quickly to a close. Notice that Paul speaks in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 twice. He uses the Greek word parousia. Well, we could venture to say, well, it's just a common word. We could do that. But again, the burden of proof would lie on us to say, okay, here's a parousia that was not near, here's a parousia that was near. Why is that important? Because Paul in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 mentions the Greek word parousia twice. And he's in the context of the wedding. And remember, the wedding was to be in AD 70, in that generation, in other words. What did James say about the parousia of Christ? Be patient, therefore, brethren, until the parousia. The parousia has drawn near. That's the literal Greek. It's the perfect tense of engekan, or it is engekan, the perfect tense of ingus, meaning that which was not near has now drawn near. So the question for Steve is, what is your guiding hermeneutic for determining that the parousia in James was an imminent event, but that the parousia of Thessalonians was not imminent, and indeed 2,000 years plus and counting away? I think we need to know that hermeneutic. Now, how much time do I have left? All right, very good. Let me try to get to just an objection or two. Steve said he did not know whether or not the persecutors were the Jews. Let's just argue this for a moment, okay? Just for argument's sake, let's say it doesn't matter who were the persecutors. I would say, weren't the Jews the countrymen of the Thessalonians? And by the way, Paul doesn't literally say that it was the Jews who persecuted. He says it was the Judeans versus these people. So he's talking about a geographical thing, not a religious thing per se. So it's Judeans were the persecutors that he... So he's not drawing a contrast necessarily between Jew versus countrymen. But of course, their countrymen could most assuredly be Jews, as I think Steve even acknowledged that. But for argument's sake, let me make the following observation. Let's set aside the Jews for a moment. Paul unequivocally was writing to living, breathing people, being persecuted. Let's forget who they're being persecuted by. And he says, to those of you who are being, not to those who will be, but to those who are being persecuted, relief when? Not one of these days, but relief when? Now, I made a point that I want to reiterate that I think is absolutely critical. You cannot give relief to someone from persecution if they are not under persecution at the time that you come to give them persecution. Who is Paul writing to? To the church of God, to the church of the Thessalonians. Well, again, Steve said that's kind of a generic type of thing as opposed to the churches in Revelation that we have specific circumstance. Well, once again, we have Romans, we have Corinthians, we have James, we have Revelation. All of them say the same thing. Those churches at that time in those cities, in those provinces, were being persecuted and invariably... The promise was that Christ was coming soon to vindicate their suffering. So the question, therefore, once again is raised. If we find the promise of imminent vindication, okay, if we find the promise of imminent vindication in all of these, quote, generic texts, then why do we not accept the promise of imminent vindication in Thessalonians? Thank you, Steve.
His last presentation by saying that I had mentioned it's easier for the full preterist. I didn't mean it's easy to be a full preterist. I got a feeling it's one of the hardest things to be. In fact, I was seriously contemplating the other day, if I were ever to become a full preterist, how would that impact my ministry? And it would end it. I'll be frank with you, that makes me very careful about being persuaded too easily. And it may, I won't pretend that I'm unlike other men and that I have no prejudices. I think it'd be very hard for Don at this point in his life to ever stop being a full preterist, even if the evidence was good, because he's invested in it. I'm invested in something else. It's hard for a man who's been teaching any given thing for a long time to just kind of turn, and especially the turn that he made when he went that direction, it alienated him from the church he was in, and that's always hard. I don't doubt that it's very hard to make the move to be a full preterist. What I meant to say is not that it's easy, but it's simpler. That is to say, the simple thing is that every time you find a passage about ultimate judgment, you know what you think about it. When I find a passage that sounds like it's about ultimate judgment, I don't automatically know what I think about it. I have to work on it. And on some of the passages, I'm undecided. I might even argue that I'm undecided in some measure about all of them, just because I don't consider myself to have 100% knowledge about any one subject or any one passage. But, we do have degrees of confidence in our present understanding. And at this point, I'm still of the mind that 1 Thessalonians 4 and that Matthew 24 are not talking about the same judgment, although much of the language obviously is duplicated in the two passages. And it's, again, it's not my interest in proving to you that they aren't. I'm just going to give you my reasons for not being persuaded that they are. And my reasons might not apply to anybody else. But there are reasons why I still do not find this identification entirely persuasive. Now, I will say this, that Don pointed out that in 1 Thessalonians 4:15, Paul said, I say to you by the word of the Lord. And I think there's a very good chance that he's right, that he is referring back to Jesus' own teaching. And it could be that he's talking about Matthew 24. I say there's a good chance of that. And if he is, I think that makes Don's case very strong. Okay? I'll just say that. I'm not 100% sure that he's saying that this is what Jesus said, because, as I think Don even mentioned, this is a possibility, though not one that he considers to be likely. It's possible that Paul is referring to words from the Lord that he's received by revelation, because Paul did receive even his gospel by revelation, he said. He didn't receive it from man. He received it from Jesus by direct revelation, he says in Galatians. So if he received even the gospel itself by direct revelation, I don't know how necessary it is to assume that the nuances of his eschatology were not given by direct revelation also. After all, Paul does say some things in this passage that I don't think are found in Matthew 24, though they may be implied there. For example, when he says that those of us who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. I'm not sure that's clear in Matthew 24. Maybe it could be found there, but Paul is giving some information here. I think that I don't think he's just expounding on Matthew 24, and he might even not be talking about Matthew 24, but it sounds like he is, because, as was pointed out, of the similar language, the parousia, for example. Now, Don pointed out that the word parousia is used, for example, in Matthew 24, that they shall see the sign of the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven or whatever, and that James also mentions the parousia in James chapter 5 and says that the parousia has drawn near. He even goes so far as to say it's at the doors, which is a clear reference to Matthew 24. You'll know that it is near, even at the doors, Jesus said. I have no doubt that James is referring to the same parousia as Matthew 24 is. I think that for one reason, he's writing essentially to the same audience, the Jews. Although James is writing to the 12 tribes that are scattered abroad, and Jesus is talking to a few Jewish men who are his disciples in Jerusalem, yet the destruction of Jerusalem had direct impact primarily on Jewish people. Now, I realize that Don sees a much bigger picture here, and even I do too. I don't think it's just a judgment on the Jews. I think it's a changing of an epoch. And Don sees it even more so than I do. But the point is that it is primarily a judgment on the Jewish people. And that is the apostate Jewish people. There were, of course, remnant Jewish people who were already part of the church at that time. But James and Jesus both are addressing Jews, as is very clear in their context. So that parousia of 70 AD is, to my mind, kind of a no-brainer. But as we pointed out, the word parousia is used somewhat generically of a lot of different things. Like, I think Don said in his first presentation tonight that I believe that Jesus came in 70 AD. That's not exactly how I would say it. I would say that a judgment from God came in 70 AD, which figuratively, following the similar figurative language of Old Testament judgments, is likened to God himself coming. Because God is the one sending the armies. It's as if he is coming in the person of the armies. He is their commander. And therefore, I don't know that I would be quite comfortable saying Jesus came in Matthew 24 in 70 AD so much as the language, the apocalyptic language of judgment, which is found in the Old Testament and the New, is spoken as if it's Jesus coming. Now, Don would like to know what hermeneutic I use to differentiate between the immediate or the near coming of the parousia in James 5 and not necessarily in 1 Thessalonians 4. Well, I actually think I use a hermeneutic that's analogous to the hermeneutic that a full preterist uses also. And that is trying to find which passages seem to be talking about the same things and which are not talking about the same things. I think that's basically the way you do biblical studies. If you try to systematize a biblical teaching on a subject, you have to first identify which passages are on the subject you're thinking about. Now, there are many passages in the Old Testament and some in the New that talk about judgments that involve trumpet sounding, shouts, angels being involved, God coming. I believe symbolically referring to armies coming at his behest. And those kinds of things. But there is one passage in 1 Thessalonians 15 that talks about the last trumpet. There are many trumpets, many judgment trumpets in the Old Testament and the New. We know in Revelation there's seven trumpets there, but I don't think the last trumpet is referring to the seventh one. I don't think Paul had read Revelation when he wrote 1 Corinthians. But the point is, there are a series throughout history, not just in the New Testament, not just associated with Revelation, but throughout history, there's a number of judgments that are likened to trumpets and shouts and angels and comings. And yet there's one judgment that Paul refers to as the last of these, the last trumpet. That's in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where he says, we shall not all sleep, that is, we'll not all die, but we will all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. He says, the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we, presumably meaning we who are still alive, will be changed. Now that sounds very much like 1 Thessalonians. It talks about the dead being raised and the living being caught up. Thessalonians doesn't talk about being changed. And 1 Corinthians 15 doesn't talk about being caught up. But both passages talk about the coming of the Lord, which involves the raising of the dead and the catching up or the changing of the living saints. Now, in 1 Corinthians, it specifically says this will happen at the last trumpet. I'm not making this a firm and, inviolable point, because the last trumpet might mean the last of some series other than the last in all of history. The word last has to be taken in whatever context it's used in. But I don't see in 1 Corinthians 15 that it's necessarily in any other context than the last judgment. And that I don't believe that 1 Corinthians 15 places that last judgment at AD 70. I know Don does, and I imagine sometime today or tomorrow we'll be able to be talking about that passage, I would think. In fact, I want to talk about the resurrection tomorrow, so that'll be an ideal time. Because I'm very interested, this is not being said as a challenge, Don. This is truly my interest. I've always wondered exactly how a full preterist really deals with these resurrection passages, and I have heard. I've actually read some and heard some references, but they're sketchy enough, but I haven't really gotten the big picture. But as I understand it, we're looking in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 not at some spiritual resurrection in AD 70 of the corporate body, although I'm willing to be persuaded, I see the evidence from the passage as being about a physical resurrection of individuals at the last trumpet, which I, in the absence of information to the contrary, I would take to be the last of all the trumpets, the last of all the judgments of that type. Now, there's a trumpet at in 70 AD that Jesus mentions in Matthew 24. He's going to come with a sound of a voice and trumpet and so forth. But Jesus doesn't say it's the last one. It might be. But I'm not necessarily persuaded because I'm not persuaded that the dead in Christ rose in AD 70 or that the living in Christ were caught up to meet the Lord in the air. Now, I realize, of course, we're looking at very possibly apocalyptic language. But I'm thinking it's more likely that we're seeing apocalyptic language in Old Testament passages and in Matthew 24 and in passages that are addressed to Jewish people who are bathed in apocalyptic than in communicating to a group like the Thessalonians. Now, I want to say this. There were Christians who were not Jews who knew apocalyptic language. The book of Revelation is a good example of that because it's written to Gentile churches and it's full of apocalyptic language. We don't know how well schooled those seven churches were in the Christian doctrine, but the Thessalonian church had not received much training. It almost appears in Acts that Paul only got to preach there for three Sabbaths, and then shortly after that he was driven out of town. And that's a few weeks after the first converts were made in Thessalonica. I don't know what the earliest teaching they received from Paul was in those few weeks, but it would be surprising if he had given them a crash course on apocalyptic language at that early point in time. I think there'd be other foundations more likely. And and the Greeks, let's face it, I know something about apocalyptic language. I've studied the Bible. I know it's there. But still, when you read this, the tendency is to take it literally unless there's compelling reason not to. And I'm not saying that the tendency is well-founded. I'm just saying that Gentile people who don't usually communicate in apocalyptic language are not going to, in something that you get given in these words, necessarily think, oh, okay, this is totally non-literal. This is apocalyptic language. One reason I think that this is different than 70 AD is because in this passage in 1 Thessalonians 4, it says, the Lord himself will descend from heaven. Now, I realize this is a matter of interpretation, and I'm interpreting it for myself. You interpret it for yourself. But when he says, the Lord himself will descend, I see this as a parallel to what the angels said in Acts 1:11. When Jesus went up, the angel said, this same Jesus whom you saw go into heaven will come again in like manner as you saw him go. This same Jesus, the Lord himself. Now see, I would see this as a contrast between that and cases where it's not, as I understand it, meant to mean the Lord himself coming, so much as it's the apocalyptic imagery of a judgment from God being described as if God is coming, as we're all familiar, I'm sure, with Isaiah 19:1, where the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come to Egypt. I don't think that Isaiah is saying that God literally came down from heaven and visited Egypt. I think it's saying the Assyrians who came into Egypt and conquered them were God's judgment. They were the hand of God. And so, to speak of God coming in many cases, I think is merely a figure of speech. But to say the Lord himself will come, the same Jesus that you saw go, he'll come back in like manner as you saw him go. That, to me, is, to my mind, a different category. Now, as far as the angel's statements, sometimes people make more than they should. And I'm not talking about full preterists. I'm talking about people who are not full preterists. Often make more than they should of the expression in like manner. I don't think it's absolutely necessary to believe that when the angel said he'll return in like manner, that it means he'll be wearing the same clothes he was wearing at the time, or that he'll come to the same mountain that he left from, or quite a few other things you could say about that departure. After all, he left only in the sight of a few people, and if I understand correctly, he's going to come back in the sight of all flesh. So, I mean, there are some things that aren't like manner. But the one thing that I think is said to be the like manner is, as you saw him go, he'll come back in like manner. You'll see him come back. At least, if I'm looking in that passage, for a particular sense in which it is in like manner that he'll come back, that seems to be the sense. This same Jesus who you saw go up into heaven will come back in like manner as you saw him go. And likewise, the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout in 1 Thessalonians 4 strikes me as being that event. Now, if it's the same as 70 AD, I'm okay with that. I just don't see that I'm compelled to see it that way. Just because of the many parallels in wording, as I said, and as Don himself has said, not only in his presentation here, but in his writings, this judgment language is frequent. It's almost generic. And because it is, I don't just assume that every time I see the word parousia or trumpet or loud voice or whatever, or even coming on clouds, I don't assume that's always talking about the same thing. So I have to take the passage by passage and weigh what I consider to be, the significant factors that may tell me, is this the same subject or not? I will say, it seems to me, and what seems to me may not be true, but I'm me. It seems to me that the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD would not have as direct an impact on the Corinthians, to whom Paul wrote 1 Corinthians 15, or on the Thessalonians, to whom he wrote 1 Thessalonians, as perhaps the full preterists would think. I think that the Gentile churches certainly would have an interest in the destruction of Jerusalem. I do, and I'm not a Jew. I'm interested in the destruction of Jerusalem. And I think they would have an interest in it. But I don't know that it would be the compelling hope of the Gentile churches. Like, my life is going to be changed totally when Jerusalem is destroyed, when God judges Jerusalem. And yet, there is a coming of the Lord that is presented to Gentile churches throughout the Roman Empire in different passages in the Bible that is held out as the great dream and hope of the believer, the fulfillment of all, that God has in mind for them. So that's my thought. Now, I'd like to say more about the wedding feast, and maybe I will in my next time because I'm pretty sure I only have about 2 minutes. But I will say one thing about the wedding feast. In Matthew 22, and I've corresponded with Don about this, so I know he doesn't see this as I do, but he sees part of it as I do. We see a king making a wedding for his son. And he invites an initial group of guests, but they make excuses and don't come. And the king hears about that, and he's furious. And he sends out his armies and destroys them and burns down their city. Now, as far as I'm concerned, it's easy to know what that's talking about. The burning down of their city is the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The Jews were the people nearest to God who were first invited, and they made excuses and didn't come, so he burned down their city. But then there's more. He said to his servants, go out to the highways and byways, and this speaks of going out to the Gentiles, to evangelize the Gentiles, and compel them to come in. And it says, and they went out and they brought in good and bad, and the wedding was furnished with guests. Now this speaks of a period after 70 AD, where people are being gathered from the whole world into the same feast, the wedding feast. And then at the end of that time, the king comes to check on the guests who have come, and he finds a man who doesn't have a wedding garment, kicks him out into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. That looks like another judgment to me. 70 AD was earlier in the story. This looks like there's a period of time of bringing in the Gentiles, followed by another sorting them out. And so I believe that Jesus himself gives the impression that there is a destruction of Jerusalem that will be followed by a later, more universal destruction after the Gentiles have been brought in. So the wedding feast is now, but the marriage where the bride and the groom come together, I believe, is not until the second coming of Christ, which I still see as a future thing. And I'm out of time.